as individuals. So I introduce to you Mr. Ryan Sorba.
All right. I'd like to thank everybody for coming out today. I'd like to briefly introduce myself. My name is Ryan Sorba. I got involved in politics in college at Cal State San Bernardino. I was a chair of the College Republicans. I took a debate class, and I learned in that debate class, it was around 2003 when gay marriage, Lawrence v. Texas had just happened. And I learned that a guy in my class had told me that ministers in Sweden were being threatened with monetary penalties and with even jail time for talking about how sodomy is an immoral act in a theological seminary and noting that same gender sexual intercourse is a sin. And that really made me angry because religious liberty is something that I hold dear. And so, you know, it made me look twice at this issue, the issue of the pro-sodomy movement in America today. And I call it that because the title of my book is The Born Gay Hoax. And there is no such thing as an inherent, intrinsic, fixed gay identity. It was a hoax. That's the name of my book, The Born Gay Hoax. So anyway, that's kind of how I got started on this issue. I was in the College Republicans. I got in a debate course. I started doing research. As chairman of the College Republicans, I got invited to a youth leadership school held by the Leadership Institute in Irvine, California, where I met a good friend of mine who was writing a book at the time, and he suggested that I take all this knowledge that I had on this issue and put it into a book. So I started working on a book. And then the Leadership Institute recruited me to become a field rep, so I went to Boston and started 22 independent conservative clubs there in the fall. And then in the spring, I came back to California and formed 8 independent conservative clubs. And I did really well. So the Intercollegiate Studies Institute asked me to come on as their director of membership. And we recruited over 13,000 members there in a single year. Aside from 1 year in the institute's past in the 80s, it was more than double their average annual membership record. So it was really, we did really well with ISI. And while I was at ISI, I had the ability to speak on college campuses in Michigan. Michigan State University, Kyle Bristow invited me to come and speak there. The Young Democratic Socialists and some other organizations were there videotaping and protesting. And I was really surprised at the response that the event received. It looked like a concert was happening outside of this hall. And I was taken aback by the size of the crowd. But it was really kind of the first real lecture that I gave on this issue. From there, I was invited to speak at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and there was a lesbian riot that occurred. I said nothing different than I'm going to say today. It was the same basic speech, and they stood outside with pots and pans, and their friends on the inside opened the windows up to the library, and they barged through and chanted, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." For me, if they want to protest, they can. If they don't have to. It's a win-win situation. If they protest, it goes up on YouTube and it gets 30,000 views. So now 30,000 people are going to hear about my book, and when it's finally released, they're going to go and purchase it. So instead of, you know, 50 or 200 people in an audience, you've got thousands of people learning about it. If they don't speak, if they don't protest, then I get to give my lecture, and there's nothing they can say because this is a history of their own movement in their own words. So it's essentially a win-win situation. I've now given about 13 lectures on this issue in California, Michigan, Northampton, Washington, D.C., and I'm glad to be here today. So with that, I'll get started. We're going to talk briefly about the origin of the gay identity, where this identity came from. But before we do that, we're going to talk about sort of the history of same-sex intercourse throughout the world. It began there's a verse in Genesis in which it says that Ham saw or uncovered Noah's nakedness. Now, there are three rival interpretations to this verse. One is that he actually sodomized Noah. One was that he slept with his own mother. And one is that he simply uncovered Noah's nakedness. I don't know which is the correct interpretation of the verse, but it was something perverse, it was something negative that Ham did to Noah. Ham's Ham had a grandson named Nimrod, who became Baal, and he married his mother wife, Semiramis, who became Ishtar. And Baal and Ishtar basically created pagan worship, and Baal or Nimrod ruled over, he ruled over Babel. And it is said that the Tower of Babylon was built, a ziggurat, in order to, that Nimrod could reach his gods of the sky, avoid a possible second flood, and to bring the people of the world together for liberty. And by liberty, he didn't mean freedom over the self, freedom from vice. He meant the liberty to do whatever your irrational appetite so inclined you to do at that moment. So it wasn't a virtuous type of liberty. It was a vicious type of liberty. It was the worship of vice. And it, within this context, nature worship became the norm. Nimrod wanted to turn people away from the rules and constraints of Noah's God, of Yahweh, and turn them toward a sort of self-worship. And within this nature worship came fertility cult, which included sodomy, sodomitical acts, sexual types of rain dances, and things like that. And this was the original context in which same-sex intercourse was engaged in. They were sort of like rain dances. And if you read the Bible and you believe the Bible, after the Tower of Babel fell, God scattered the languages across the globe and scattered the ethnicities. And that's why you have a form of nature worship everywhere, from South America to North America, from Europe to Africa. And you've got acts of sodomy occurring in many of these cultures. And it seems like the evidence points to the fact that there was this common nature worship initiated by Nimrod, Baal and Ishtar, Baal worship. And then it spread across the globe along with it. And so Baal worship, a sort of extreme libertine type philosophy and of liberty, and Christian liberty, of ordered liberty, of virtue, balanced with freedom, have always been at war. And so this philosophy, this war is actually deeper than simply, you know, same gender sexual, the right to engage in any form of sexual act that you, that your irrational appetite so inclined you to engage in at the moment. This is a deeper issue. This goes down to what it truly means to be free, and who we are as human beings, what human nature is, and that sort of thing. So anyway, that's kind of what the issue is at core. Now with the Greeks, with Sparta came warrior cult. With warrior cults, they theorized that they could create hyper-masculine armies, and so they trained males to love other males so that when they went out for long periods of time to war, the men wouldn't be angry because they had no women, and they would fight harder because they'd be fighting for their true love out at war. And this was sort of the beginning of any type of historical record of more long-term type same-gender sexual relationships. And then obviously in Athens, pederastia, or men having sex with children or adolescents, became widespread. The child was expected to play the passive role. The adult was expected to play the active role, train the student, and in return the student engaged in pederastia with the adult. And this Greek sexuality was organized not around male or female, but around active or passive partners. There was no conceptualization of an intrinsic, inherent sexual identity. It didn't exist. So there are a few other sexual conceptions that have existed around the globe, none of which had anything to do with any kind of innate sexual identity as a center of who a person is. There were three Greeks who came up with a theory of biologic sexuality during this sort of high noon of pederastia when it was occurring everywhere, which is kind of to be expected. But prior to 1862, there is no known record of a human being claiming to they themselves have been born gay. Nobody. Or Uranian or sodomite or any other term that may have been used to describe the behavior throughout history. It just didn't exist. So in 1862, a little over 150 years ago, The first concept of an inborn homosexual condition began to circulate in Germany, aside from these three other theories that occurred but were very disparate and really didn't carry any weight historically. Prior to this time, 1862, there is no known record of a human being ever claiming to they themselves having been born gay or with an innate same-sex attraction. The originator of the novel concept was Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, the grandfather of the world gay rights movement. Ulrichs was a lawyer, a political activist, and a known pedophile. At the age of 14, Ulrichs was seduced by his male riding instructor, a man about 30 years old. Observers familiar with the high correlation between childhood sexual molestation and adult same-sex attraction might conclude that this early molestation experience was the cause of his later fixation with the same gender. Then, circa 1860, in an effort to garner support to repeal paragraph 175 of the German Penal Code, which criminalized sodomy, Ulrichs began to spread a theory that defined individuals experiencing same-sex attraction as members of a third gender. Ulrichs proposed that individuals who develop same-sex attraction do so because of a psycho-spiritual mix-up in which a man's body becomes inhabited by a woman's soul and vice versa for women. Ulrichs coined the terms earning for males and dalings for females to refer to members of his third gender, which was neither male nor female but a combination of both. The term Uranian was introduced in 1862 as a new designation for same-gender sexuality in general for both earnings and dalings. So now the term Uranian was used kind of like the term gay is today. Ulrichs took this term from Plato's Symposium, in which same-sex Eros is said to fall under the protection of the ninth muse, Urania. And Ulrichs reasoned that since same-sex attractions were innate and natural, according to him, sodomy should not be criminalized. So, and although Ulrichs was ultimately unsuccessful in abolishing sodomy laws during this time, his efforts were influential, as evidenced by the swell of political activism and public sympathy for Uranians during this time in Germany. During this time in Germany, the social conditions were similar to what they are today. There were sex bars. It was a very libertine type attitude in Germany, and this seems to be the context in which same-sex intercourse becomes prevalent in a culture. So it was amidst this changing political climate that a German-Hungarian writer by the name of Karoly Maria Benkert, writing under the pseudonym Karoly Maria Kertbeny, coined the term homosexual. This is where the term homosexual comes from, Karoly Maria Kertbeny, in an open letter to the Prussian Prime Minister of Justice in 1869. Prior to this, men and women who engaged in same-gender sex acts were known as sodomites, pederasts, or Nebenschandler, literally boy ravishers. That's how intertwined pedophilia and homosexuality were. The two terms were used, you know, interchangeably. So Ulrichs and Kertbeny understood that public opposition to sodomy sprang from the people's understanding of it as an unnatural and irrational act. In order to counter the behavioral connotations linked with terms like sodomite and boy ravisher, Ulrichs and Kertbeny set out to coin new terms that would refer to a sexual identity rather than a specific behavior. They were successful, and in fact, their most influential accomplishments proved to be the coining of the terms Uranian and homosexual. During this time, German men who were engaging in sodomy began to refer to themselves as Uranians, and a militant slogan, Uranians of the World Unite, was used internationally. Although Ulrich's identity-based term would fail to stick long-term, Kertbeny's term homosexual proved to have more lasting appeal because it got picked up by psychiatry. And it raised the stakes. It made the behavior go from a behavior to a condition. And then with the term gay, it brought it up from a condition to an identity. Social critic Mark Stein describes how the coining of terms by activists has played a central role in the movement to normalize same-gender sexual activity by subtly influencing public opinion via the lexicon. Historically, Stein explains moral concern for sexual activity between two persons of the same gender was identified as sodomy and act. One can either think of sodomy as an acceptable or unacceptable act. Either way, it is an act that someone chooses. Then Stein explains that in the late 19th century, the act was re-described as a condition of certain persons, and it was termed homosexuality. Only a few decades ago, homosexuality was upgraded again, this time referring to a person's very identity, so that now we identify people as being gay or straight or somewhere in between. Now that the term describes who a person is. It has become as fundamental to one's identity as race. And this is false. And Stein explains, each formulation raises the stakes. One can object to and even criminalize an act, but one is obligated to be sympathetic toward a condition. But once it's a full-fledged 24/7 identity, like being Hispanic, Inuit, anything less than wholehearted acceptance gets you marked down as a bigot. Ulrich's sociopolitical strategy established itself as a working model in late 19th century Germany. However, oncoming political turmoil both within the pro-sodomy movement in Germany and throughout Germany pushed this early pro-sodomy movement underground, and Ulrich's strategy was destined to lie explicitly dormant for nearly a century. Yet its influence survived implicitly in the language. Ulrich's third gender theory established a new concept for the masses, and this concept carried with it an entirely new blueprint for society's future. So that is sort of, in a nutshell, the beginning of the gay identity. And now we're going to talk about how that identity came to America. How did it get here? How did it migrate? Well, let's talk about the goal of the movement, and then we'll talk about I'll read you a quote from Adolf Brand. He was an activist in Germany during this time. He said that the positive goal of this movement is the revival of Hellenic chivalry and its recognition by society. By chivalric love, we mean, in particular, close friendships between youths and even more particularly the bonds between men of unequal ages. This was the core of the German pro-sodomy movement that migrated to America. And we're going to go over it right now, and you'll see that the movement was actually passed down through a series of molestations. From a guy named Henry Gerber through Champ Simmons down to Harry Hay, who founded the Mattachine Society, the first truly national pro-sodomy movement in America, who was also a major NAMBLA supporter and a pedophile himself. And also he participated in occultic rituals, pagan Baal Ishtar type rituals. So shortly after Ulrich's death in 1895, the pro-sodomy movement in Germany split into two separate and opposed factions. One faction followed Ulrich's successor, Magnus Hirschfeld, the other a young anarchist, Adolf Brand. What divided the movement in Germany was gender identity. Hirschfeld and his followers embraced an effeminate identity. As in the tradition of Ulrich's, while Brand and his followers perceived themselves as hyper-masculine, as in the Greek tradition. In 1897, Magnus Hirschfeld formed the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, who was dedicated to two goals. The organization was dedicated to two goals. The first was to overturn anti-sodomy laws, paragraph 175 of the German Penal Code, and the second was to work to legitimize acts of sodomy within the culture. Although Hirschfeld was originally committed to Ulrich's third gender theory of an inborn fixed Uranian gay identity or condition, he later abandoned it. Hirschfeld believed that persons experiencing same-sex attraction were the equivalent of handicapped due to hormonal imbalance. So he believed that they could be cured. He didn't believe it to be an ethnic type thing. He believed it to be a condition that could be cured. So he didn't go as far as Ulrich's did. He also considered same-sex attraction to be curable through hormone treatment. The acknowledgement of a curable same-sex attraction undoubtedly arose after Hirschfeld observed the general sexual confusion of the patients he worked with same-sex attraction at his Institute for Sex Research in Berlin, which was the predecessor to Alfred Kinsey's Institute for Sex Research in the U.S., founded in 1947. So Hirschfeld's femme faction dominated the early pro-sodomy movement in Germany, but it didn't have much of an effect long-term there because the hyper-masculine faction gained supremacy there. Adolf Brand, Wilhelm Janssen, and Benedict Friedlander, on May 1, 1902, three pederasts, formed the Community of the Special. And they fashioned themselves as a modern incarnation of the warrior cults of ancient Greece, Sparta, Thebes, and Crete. Members of the CS were ultra-masculine, male supremacists, and pederastic, devoted to man-boy sex. Brand once wrote that he wanted men who thirst for a revival of Greek times and Hellenic standards of beauty after centuries of Christian barbarism. The CS wanted German society to revert to pagan values. The positive goal is a revival of Hellenic chivalry and its recognition by society. And by chivalric love, we mean in particular those close friendships between youths and even more particularly the bonds between men of unequal ages. So they published a journal called The Ferry. They got up to 150,000 subscriptions. And they dominated the German pro-sodomy movement up into the 20s. The first pro-sodomy organization in the United States was an American chapter of this German-based hyper-masculine movement, which a man named Hans Konart in Germany founded. It was a branch off of the Community of the Special. And the first American pro-sodomy organization was the Society for Human Rights, the SHR. It was the American counterpart to the German hyper-masculine faction of the pro-sodomy movement devoted to man-boy love, essentially. And Hans Konart's Society for Human Rights. So the American SHR was founded on December 10th, 1924 in Chicago by the German-American Henry Gerber. Now, Henry Gerber served with the U.S. occupation forces in Germany from 1920 to 1923. While in Germany, from 1920 to 1923, Gerber became involved with the German SHR. When Gerber returned to America, he legally chartered an SHR chapter together with a small group of, quote, revolutionaries without revealing its purpose to the state. Soon they began publishing a pro-sodomy journal called Friendship and Freedom, patterned after the German chapter's publication of the same name. In 1925, the organization collapsed when Henry Gerber, Vice President Al Menninger, and another member were arrested on charges of sexually abusing a boy. All three were turned in by Menninger's wife. The Chicago Examiner ran the story, "Strange Sex Cult Exposed," and spoke of strange doings in Menninger's apartment. Menninger confessed, but Gerber claimed that the incident was a setup, saying that their arrests were shades of the Holy Inquisition. Upon Gerber's release from prison, he continued his activism underground, writing under the pen name Parasex. He also retained his ties to the German SHR and published several articles in their publication. Gerber resurfaced in 1934 when he joined the staff of a pro-sodomy literary magazine called Chanticleer. In Chanticleer, Gerber revealed himself as a militant socialist who regarded capitalism and Christianity as the twin pillars of ignorance and the repression of sexual freedom. Despite Gerber's work, his chapter of the SHR was only an aberration. The demand and leadership for a sustaining pro-sodomy organization in the United States would not emerge until 1948. On 1948, at the tail end of an 18-year stint as an American Communist Party leader, Henry Harry Hay, lived from 1912 to 2002, who is regarded as the founder of the modern gay rights movement, began to organize a group that would eventually come to be known as the Mattachine Society. Although the society did not officially receive its name until the spring of 51, it is seen from the beginning as a vehicle to destroy social restraints against sodomy within American culture. At the age of 14, Henry Hay, like Carl Ulrichs, was sexually abused by an older man, in this case about 25 years old. Later in life, Hay defined himself as a neo-pagan and participated in occultic rituals at the Los Angeles Lodge of the Order of the Eastern Temple, Aleister Crowley's notorious anti-Christian spiritual group. So Aleister Crowley's group Harry Hay was a member of. Hay also provided musical accompaniment to ceremonies performed by lesbian high priestesses. He also founded a new age group called the Radical Fairies, which met in an Azram in the high desert of Arizona to offer invocations to pagan spirits. Hay also believed in pederasty, man-boy sex, to be an essential part of the pro-sodomy movement in America and openly endorsed the North American Man-Boy Love Association. Henry Hay was Carl Ulrich's American counterpart in several ways. Both men launched an enduring social movement in their respective cultures. The avowed purpose of each was to undermine the Judeo-Christian moral consensus in respect to acts of sodomy, and both had been sexually abused at a young age. Unlike Ulrichs, however, Hay became increasingly militant as time went on, until in the 80s he participated in California's notoriously violent ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power demonstrations. Though Hay was in his 70s and is not directly linked with any of the property destruction caused by ACT UP, his presence validated their terroristic tactics. Harry Hay's Mattachine Society spawned large-scale pro-sodomy political and social activism that soon outgrew his expectations and control. Hay's highly motivated activists operated in groups designed like communist cells, each a secret fraternity bound by a common vice. As Hay stated in a later interview, "We want to keep them underground and separate so that no one group will ever know who the other members are." Slowly at first, from innumerable obscure sources, came theories, public statements, and actions. in support of the social acceptance of homosexuality. As the power of the pro-sodomy political lobby grew, so did the ugliness of its demands and its methods. Now, so we've talked so far about the origin of the nature of same-sex intercourse throughout history, being tied up with pagan rituals. And then we talked about the origin of the gay identity, and then how that identity migrated to America, and how this movement, this pro-sodomy movement, was still tied up with pagan Baal, Nimrod, Baal, Semiramis, Ishtar type activities, with these, you know, occult rituals in the desert, you know, and invocations to spirits and things like that. So, you know, I noticed, I went to Barnes & Noble bookstore the other day, and I noticed the New Age section is right next to the gay lesbian resource section. And I wonder, you know, there's no coincidence there. These two movements have been tied together from the beginning. So, we'll talk real briefly. The sexual revolution played a huge part in normalizing same-sex intercourse in America. The sexual revolution, I'm just going to kind of summarize. Kinsey released his Kinsey report. Then he went around to college campuses and spoke about his reports and his findings. Hugh Hefner cited Alfred Kinsey as the here's what he said. He said that if Kinsey was the researcher of the sexual revolution, I was the pamphleteer. And so Playboy magazine serves as a social engineering tool in that the existence of a thriving pornography industry morally corrupts the men who use it, logically making them less likely to oppose sodomy on moral grounds and more likely to support public policies which legitimize sexual license. Exposure to pornography at a young age has also been shown to be a gateway into struggles with same-sex attraction and sodomy. In a similar way, the pro-sodomy cause was advanced by a successful abortion industry, which arose in response to the sexual revolution. The choice to murder one's own unborn child morally compromises both men and women, making them unwilling to criticize the choices of others to engage in other forms of immoral behavior. It also ensures that an unwanted child will not be a lasting deterrent to those who choose sexual license over family. In addition, the acceptance of sexual indulgence as an important social value initiates a downward moral spiral in a culture. In American society, the selling of the idea of recreational sex to young men in the 1950s by Kinsey created a market for immodest and sexually adventurous young women, which in turn helped to legitimize the idea of female sexual promiscuity. In the 60s, once immodesty and promiscuity became acceptable for some women, the pressure increased for all women, competing for the attention of the same men to adopt these behaviors. This was especially true of the youngest marriage-age girls of the generation. And the wholesale entrance of women into the world of sexual license then created a number of societal demands. It created the demand for a second-wave feminist movement to liberate women from societal expectations about marriage and child-rearing. The National Organization of Women was formed in 1966. For contraception on demand, Griswold v. Connecticut, 1966. For abortion on demand, Roe v. Wade, 1973. For no-fault divorce, state-by-state liberalization of divorce laws began in the 70s. The result of these policies has been the achievement of a pansexualist goal as embodied by Kinsey's teachings, a progressive denormalization of marriage and the steady normalization of sexual license. The census data in 98 showed a fourfold increase in divorce from 1970 to 1996, while the population of cohabiting couples more than doubled. Obviously, among the side effects of the destruction of the family include a 560% increase in violent crime from 1960 to 1990, more than 400% increase in illegitimate births, a quadrupling of the divorce rate, tripling of the percentage of children living in single-parent homes. Parents used to have lots of children, now children have lots of parents. More than a 200% increase in the teenage suicide rate, a drop of almost 80 points in the SAT scores. The social regression of the last 30 years is due in large part to the enfeebled state of our social institutions, such as the family, and their failure to carry out a critical and time-honored task of moral education of the young. So the sexual revolution played a huge part in the advance of the pro-sodomy movement in America. Real briefly, I'm going to go over this briefly because of time's sake. The Stonewall Riots was kind of a symbol It showed, it was truly the first sort of homo-fascist example that we have here in America. And the homo-fascism that was initiated with the Stonewall riots spilled over into the debate in the American Psychiatric Association in their debates to whether or not to remove homosexuality as a psychological disorder. So, the Stonewall riots, just like in Germany, there was a hyper-masculine faction of pro-sodomy activists that took over. In America, there was a hyper, not necessarily masculine, but fascistic type, hyper-aggressive type homosexual activism that took over. And that's essentially what the Stonewall riots symbolize. They were having sex in parks, in bushes, in Macy's department store bathrooms. They had a gay bar on Christopher Street called the Stonewall Inn, where they would regularly have sex with minors. And the police conducted a raid, and they rioted there, throwing Molotov cocktails and things like that. And that was sort of the beginning of the hyper-aggressive form of activism that then influenced the APA. Really briefly, I'll go over the APA with you. The APA was predominantly influenced by Evelyn Hooker's study, which has subsequently been debunked. Evelyn Hooker was a UCLA psychologist and psychiatrist, and she, when she became a professor there, a couple of her students were struggling with same-sex attraction, engaging in same gender intercourse, and they became her friends. They'd hang out with her after class, talk to her, became their friends. They gained her sympathy. They knew she was a psychiatrist. They said, hey, look what these psychiatrists are writing about us. We'd like you to, you know, research this and prove them wrong. So she went into it with a bias. And then, you know, Alfred Kinsey's study played a role. The Kinsey study and the Evelyn Hooker study gave the hyper-aggressive homo-fascist type activists their intellectual backing for what they were saying. You know, they can go and protest all they want, but this gave them an intellectual backup. And anyways, they began to protest at APA meetings around the country, disrupt APA meetings around the country. The APA caved into their demands. They basically said, if you'll be quiet, we'll give you panels at our conventions. Instead of, you know, bringing police in to police these people, they caved in and said, just be quiet, we'll give you a panel. They basically networked within the APA and were able to make connections, were able to sympathize with certain psychiatrists, largely on civil rights grounds. And Robert Spitzer, who was the head of the nomenclature that categorized mental disorders, they got in good with him. And he sympathized with them on civil rights grounds. Now, he conducted a study in 2002, right around there, that said that they can change their sexual orientation. But he sympathized with them on civil rights grounds. It was the 70s, the 60s had just happened. People were sympathetic to civil rights during this time. And that was what it was all about. And they fundamentally changed the definition of what it meant to have a mental disorder during this time. Prior to this, it was if you have some sort of anxiety or something that inhibits the natural function of your design, you're disordered. You've got something inhibiting the natural function of your design. Now it became, if you feel bad about what you're doing, it's a psychological disorder. So you can do whatever you want as long as you don't feel bad about it, as long as it doesn't affect you. That's a terrible definition for a psychological disorder. And, you know, the natural law definition for a psychological disorder is detachment from reality, which I think is the ultimate definition of a psychological disorder. Anything that detaches a person from reality plunges them into psychological illusion. And that's what I believe the person with same-sex attraction is detached from the reality of the nature of their physical body. They are their body. Their body is a part of who they are. They're not abstract consciousnesses inhabiting impersonal bodies like a ghost in a machine. They are their body. And they're going to have to live with it as it is and not slam the door in their own face on their own body, you know what I mean? Divide themselves into a kind of dualistic human being. But that's for later. So the APA was influenced by this hyper-masculine, hyper-aggressive homo-fascism and the networking, and that's kind of how they got that. But right now we're going to talk about the Born Gay hoax in and of itself, how it got started. I'll start with a quote from Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen in their book, After the Ball, which talks explicitly about men having sex with adolescents. Read their book. It's all about men having sex with adolescents. They have a whole chapter about how the young men don't think the old men are attractive anymore, and how to make the young, socially engineer the young to find older men attractive again. This is what their book's about. This is the blueprint for the modern gay rights movement. It's sickening. And you know, people in culture haven't been exposed to it. They don't understand. And so what I'm trying to do is to let them know, to educate them, to let them know where this came from. So here's one of their quotes. It is time to learn from Madison Avenue and to roll out the big guns. We are talking about propaganda. Okay? They admit we are talking about propaganda. So we'll get started on the hoax, the born gay hoax. The born gay hoax was essentially invented in 1985 by Marshall Kirk and Dr. Hunter Madsen. Kirk graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University in 1980, majoring in psychology, and went on to become a writer and researcher in neuropsychiatry. Dr. Hunter Madsen earned a PhD in politics from Harvard University in 1985, then went on to become an expert on public persuasion tactics, social marketing, and has designed commercial marketing on Madison Avenue. He has also served as a consultant to pro-sodomy media campaigns across the country. So these guys are psychiatry types. They know about propaganda, about classical conditioning, operant conditioning, desensitization. They know about these things. These are the guys kind of paving the way here. In 1985, Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen co-authored an article entitled The Gay Agenda. We always hear about the gay agenda. And the left says, oh, there's a gay agenda. What's the gay agenda? The Christians say there's this gay agenda. They wrote an article called The Gay Agenda. What else are we supposed to call it? And they published it in a magazine called Christopher Street. Christopher Street was the street the Stonewall Inn was on, Stonewall Riots. In short, the article emphasized the strategic importance of shifting the central issue in the debate over homosexuality away from sodomy, away from a behavior, and toward a sexual pseudo-identity called gay. The goal of the gay agenda was to force opponents of sodomy into a position where they would be seen as attacking the civil rights of the so-called gay citizen rather than opposing a specific antisocial behavior. The gay agenda also briefly outlined the strategy that would eventually be used to convince the public that individuals were born gay. Initially, there wasn't any enthusiasm for the gay agenda within the pro-sodomy movement. They wanted to recruit. You came out of the 60s with the hippies. They just wanted free love. They wanted to recruit. They had Camp Sister Spirit where they'd bring girls to recruit them. That's what they wanted to do. So they didn't want to adopt the strategy that would limit the numbers of people who could claim to be gay because it was going to be exclusive. And so there was no initial enthusiasm for this gay agenda. And they also viewed rights related to sexuality as analogous to the constitutional rights to association, expression, or religion. So they said, this is my right to express myself. I don't have to lie or cheat or swindle my way into anything. Initially, there were strong reservations against adopting the strategy. However, these reservations wouldn't last long because in 1986, the pro-sodomy movement lost Bowers v. Hardwick, the United States Supreme Court case which upheld the rights of states to criminalize sodomy. The loss was devastating to the pro-sodomy movement. Desperate, angry, and galvanized, pro-sodomy activists learned that if they could make a compelling case that they were born gay, that they could become eligible for minority status as a suspect class under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And if minority status were granted, they felt that it could force the courts to overturn Bowers v. Hardwick, thus giving them a way to legalize sodomy. So, it should be noted, however, that the Civil Rights Act recognizes minority status only for those groups who, one, have suffered a long history of discrimination, two, are powerless to help themselves as a community, and three, are a protected class status or are born that way. And that's the key. The legalization of sodomy by way of minority status is a secret to understanding why pro-sodomy activists adopted the strategy outlined in the gay agenda in the late 80s and began to promote the Ulrichsian-type claim that people are born gay. Now, there was another reason as well, and that was public sympathy. Because obviously, there were articles in the New York Times that came out that stated that if people believed that sexual orientation was innate and fixed, that they would be more liberal and gay-friendly. And so it was to gain public acceptance and legal acceptance. But obviously, the law came first. In the following year, so essentially wasting little time, Kirk and Madsen writing under the pseudonym, Erastes Pill. Erastes is the dominant male in a pederastic child molester relationship. He wrote under the name Erastes. He's the architect of the gay agenda. Gays don't have anything to do with pedophiles. Yes, they do. And here's, I mean, the guy that brought the entire movement forward called himself Erastes Pill. Give me a break. I still haven't figured out what pill stands for symbolically, but I know what Erastes means. They published a follow-up to the gay agenda entitled The Overhauling of Straight America. This article, which appeared in the Pro-Sodomy publication Guide in November of 1987, outlined a point-by-point strategy that could be used to convince straight America that men and women who develop same-sex attraction are born gay. And then in the following year, in 1988, they called a war conference of 175 leading pro-sodomy activists representing organizations from every part of the United States, and they convened in Warrenton, Virginia. The purpose of the conference, according to Kirk and Madsen, was to establish an official agenda for the newly conceived gay movement. The gay movement, founded by a guy who called himself Erastes, a pedophile, who was in favor of pederastia. The gay movement was founded by a pedophile. Okay? If I was in the gay movement, which I'm glad I'm not, I would not want to be called gay. It was founded by a pedophile. Okay? And same-sex attraction and intercourse is detached enough from reality, but molestation too. At this war conference, pro-sodomy activists adopted the identity politics strategy outlined in the gay agenda and the overhauling of straight America, and the born gay hoax was born. Subsequently, in 1989, Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen expanded their article, The Overhauling of Straight America, into a book entitled After the Ball. Now, After the Ball refers to during one of the APA conventions. They invited Robert Spitzer to, there's a secret gay faction within the APA called the Gay PA. And during all the conventions, they hosted a secret meeting, and they invited Robert Spitzer to one in order to try to kind of like desensitize him and introduce him to the members of the group, so that he would, be more sympathetic towards them, kind of put a human face to the issue type thing. So, after the ball, after we got sodom or same-sex attraction or homosexuality removed as a psychological disorder, after the ball, how America will conquer its fear and hatred of the gays in the 90s. So, that was the title of their book, After the Ball. In this deliberately deceitful agenda in After the Ball, where they talk ad nauseum about man-child sexual relationships, in their book, they explain their deliberately deceitful agenda for America when they write that they intend to get tough on straights. That's what they write. It's time to get tough on straights. It's time to learn from Madison Avenue, to roll out the big guns. We're talking about propaganda. Kirk and Madsen explain the central tenet of their strategy in the book. The public should be persuaded that gays are victims of circumstance, that they no more chose their sexual orientation than they did, say, their height, skin color, talents, or other limitations. We argue that for all practical purposes, gays should be considered to have been born gay. Even though, they write in their own words, even though sexual orientation for most humans seems to be a product of a complex interaction between innate predispositions and environmental factors during childhood and early adolescence. So they admit straight up that they're lying. They say, we are lying. That's what they say, we are lying. The authors here admit that human sexuality seems to be the product of a complex interaction between innate predispositions and environmental factors in childhood and in adolescence, yet they urge readers to abandon the truth for practical purposes to further the gay agenda. They could have not been clearer about their plan to deceive Americans. The gay agenda, its cumulative post-luminaries, and efforts to employ the tactics outlined in these documents are what I refer to as the born gay hoax. It is a hoax. The following excerpts from the book After the Ball will exemplify the manipulative tactics Kirk and Madsen entice pro-sodomy activists to employ. So they say the first order of business is desensitization. expose people to the behavior until they lose their natural revulsion to it. To desensitize the public is to help it view homosexuality with indifference instead of keen emotion. Ideally, we would have the straight register differences in sexual preference of the way they would register differences in taste for ice cream. The masses should not be shocked and repelled by premature exposure to the behavior. The imagery of sex should be downplayed. Gays must be cast as victims in need of protection so that straights will be inclined by reflex to assume the role of protector. And, I mean, college-age girls are the biggest victims of this lie that they entice people to use. Anytime you argue on a college campus, some girl will be like, my friend is gay. And you know, you feel bad for them because they've been lied to. But it's like, read this and think about it for a half an hour. Gays must be cast as victims so that we can use and manipulate straights so that they will be inclined by reflex to assume the role of protector. That's terrible. Make use of symbols which reduce the mainstream's sense of threat, which lower its guard. Replace the mainstream's self-righteous pride about its homophobia with shame and guilt. Talk about gays and gayness as loudly and often as possible. That's Hitler's big lie technique. The principle behind this advice is simple. Almost all behavior begins to look normal if you're exposed to it enough and at close quarters and among your acquaintances. Constant talk builds the impression that public opinion is at least divided on the subject. They had pro-sodomy activists within the APA write tons of articles during this time so that psychiatrists would think, oh, well, opinion's divided. No, it's not. These same guys are writing a bunch of stuff to make it look that way. They explain their scheme in greater depth and they write, where we talk is important. The visual media, film and television, are the most powerful image makers in Western civilization. The average American household watches over 7 hours of TV combined during those hours, they open up a gateway into the private world of straights through which a Trojan horse might be passed. As far as desensitization is concerned, the medium is the message of normalcy. So far, gay Hollywood has provided the gays' best covert weapon in the battle to desensitize the American mainstream. You know, these statements are unbelievably offensive, and they would have been several years ago to most Americans, even if they contain no reference to homosexuality, precisely because they all advocate the coercive tampering with people's most private domain, their thoughts, opinions, and beliefs. Kirk and Madsen call it transforming the social values of straight America. Let's look a little bit closer at their mechanics. Would a desensitizing campaign of open and sustained talk about gay issues reach every rabid opponent of homosexuality, they write? Of course not. While public opinion is one primary source of mainstream values, religious authority is the other. When churches condemn gays, there are only two things we can do to confound the homophobia of true believers. First, we can use talk to muddy the moral waters, essentially bring about false doctrines and claim their legitimate Christianity. Use talk to muddy the moral waters, to muddy Christianity, which means essentially lying about Christianity, which, I mean, is that not, you know, Christophobic or homofascist? I mean, how are we homophobic for defending the actual, you know, contextual interpretation of the Bible? So they say we can use talk to muddy the moral waters. This means publicizing support for gays by more moderate churches, raising theological objections of our own about current interpretations of biblical teachings, and exposing hatred and inconsistency. They say we can also undermine the moral authority of homophobic churches by portraying them as antiquated and backwards, badly out of step with the times and with the latest findings of psychology. Against the mighty pull of institutional religion, one must set the mightier draw of science and public opinion, the shield and sword of that accursed secular humanism. Such an unholy alliance has worked well in the past against churches before on such topics as divorce and abortion. With enough open talk about the prevalence and acceptability of homosexuality, that alliance can work again here. So they go on and on. I've got about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to skip some more of the Kirk and Madsen quotes because I think you get the idea, and go into quotes from other activists that explicitly admit that they're lying about people being born gay. And I've got all kinds of example here of where they use these techniques against, like, Jesse Helms and against Jerry Falwell in commercials and magazine articles and things like that. So, I mean, it's appalling to hear their tactics, but now let's go to some other leading activists and see what they have to say. In specialized press, activists speak candidly and openly about the movement's purely practical purposes for promoting the idea that people are born gay. In doing so, they admit that the public born gay rhetoric is fabricated propaganda, contrived and carried out for specific political ends, mainly the overturning of Bowers and the normalization of sodomy. Today it's the normalization of sodomy. Bowers has been overturned by Lawrence v. Texas, and now it's just to gain public acceptance and new recruits. And special, so let's go to Dr. Lillian Faderman, who has won the Monet Horowitz Award from the pro-sodomy activist group Lambda Literary Foundation. She states, "We continue to demand rights, ignoring the fact that human sexuality is fluid and flexible, acting as though we are all stuck in our category forever." She further states, "The narrow categories of identity politics are obviously deceptive. It becomes obvious later in the article from which the above quotes are pulled that Dr. Faderman sees a political threat, though, from the truth, from the fluidity of sexuality." She says, "I must confess I'm both elated and terrified by the possibilities of a bisexual movement. I'm elated because I truly believe that bisexuality is a human condition. I don't, because I believe that our physical design matters." But she understands that emotions are fluid, that reason is fixed. My view is that reason is fixed, emotions are fluid, and that we should order our emotions in accord with reason by way of our will. She believes that, you know, emotions are all, and so that anything your emotions pull you toward. So in that case, yeah, people are, if they're brainwashed from the time they're babies, capable of bisexuality. That's what I'm afraid of and why I'm fighting against this movement, so people don't plunge into illusion like that evil. "So I must confess that I'm elated and terrified by the possibilities of a bisexual moment," she writes. "I'm elated because I truly believe bisexuality is a human condition, but I'm much less happy when I think of huge numbers of homosexuals and two-thirds of lesbians running off to explore the heterosexual side of their bisexual potential and decimating our political ranks." Here she admits two-thirds of lesbians already sleep with men who claim to be lesbian. And lesbians tend to have more sexual partners than straight women do, more male sexual partners. And so lesbian women have more male sexual partners than straight women do. So, I mean, how's that statistic for you? She also writes, "The gay and lesbian identity may be nothing but a social construct, but it has been crucial in enabling us to become a political movement and demand the rights that are due to us as a minority. What becomes of our political movement if we openly acknowledge sexuality is flexible and fluid, that gay and lesbian is not a people, but a sometime behavior?" John DeCecco is a psychologist, director of the Center of Research and Education in Sexuality at San Francisco State University, editor of the Journal of Homosexuality and the Journal of Pedica, which is all about child molestation. DeCecco calls himself gay, but insists that the attractions are changeable, a changeable preference, not an orientation. He explains in his book, If You Seduce a Straight Person, Can You Make Them Gay?, that the whole born gay and immutable characteristic idea is just gay and lesbian politics and is aimed at achieving gay rights. Dr. Vera Wissman writes in her book, Queer by Choice, Lesbians, Gay Men, and the Politics of Identity, "The political dangers of a choice discourse go beyond the simple if controversial notion that some people genuinely choose their homosexuality. Indeed, my conclusions question some of the fundamental bases upon which the gay and lesbian rights movement has been built. If we cannot make political claims based on an essential and shared nature, are we not left once again as individual deviants? Without an essentialist born gay foundation, do we even have a viable politics at all?" Lesbian writer Jenny Ruby admits, "I don't think lesbians are born, I think they're made. But the gay rights movement has, for many good practical reasons, adopted largely an identity politics." Jan Clausen, lesbian of an author of the book Apples and Oranges, writes, "What's got to stop is the rigging of history." So she's against this born gay hoax, kind of. But she's against the lies, but she's for the results, just like the rest of these activists. In her book, Apples and Oranges, she writes, "What's got to stop is the rigging of history to make the either or look permanent. I understand, though, why this argument may sound erotic for outsiders, for whom the public assertion of a coherent, unchanging lesbian and gay identity has proved an indispensable tactic in the battle against homophobic persecution." Later, Clausen quotes the popular lesbian poet Audre Lorde. When Audre Lorde wrote, "I do not believe all our lies, all our wants have made all our lies holy." Lynn Harn and Elaine Miller explain their feelings regarding the born gay hoax. "There's nothing natural in lesbianism," they write. "It's a positive choice and a political one. in the lesbian magazine Girlfriends, an article states, "No wonder lesbians are so nervous. What makes the lesbian movement strong is the formation of a collective identity unified behind a sexual orientation as a category. If bisexuality undoes that, it kicks the lesbian movement where it hurts, in the heart and soul of identity politics." The National Center for Lesbian Rights, one of the activist groups that pressured the APA to reject reparative therapy, claimed that the gay identity is innate and unchangeable. Joanne Lolan is a psychotherapist who served on the board of directors of the organization. She made hypocritical headlines in 1997 in The Advocate because she reportedly changed her own sexual orientation. So she went to the APA and said, "Stop reparative therapy. People can't change." And then she went and changed. It's ridiculous. Kate Kendall, another person serving on the board of directors of the NCLR, wrote an article for an Insider's magazine arguing that sexuality is fluid and flexible. But she went to the APA and said, "No, reparative therapy doesn't work. It's like pouring bleach on a black person's skin to make them white. It's not going to work. It's an identity. It's fixed." And then she writes an article again that says, "No, it's not fixed. I just said that so that we could, you know, make advances." Those who have been tricked by the propaganda, though, have little for which to be ashamed. There's no shame in believing a lie until you learn the truth. The truth is that beginning in 1985, the gay agenda was sold to the American public by pro-sodomy propagandists. The carefully calculated lies of these propagandists are blatant and have been admitted in numerous publications. This is just the tip of the iceberg. We've got them admitting across the country and across the years that this is a lie, a gigantic propaganda campaign. I mean, I can't read them all in the course of an hour, but if you want more, send me an email, rsorbet@youngconservativesofcalifornia.com. It is obvious that born gay propagandists from Kirk and Madsen on keep the fact of sexual fluidity secret from the straight community for political reasons. Pro-sodomy activists, however, as evidenced by their own articles, talk about the born gay hoax and the reality of sexual choice regularly amongst themselves. So it's that essentially concludes my talk today. If you have any questions, I can go ahead and take those. I'll just really quick sum up everything that I had to say today. Throughout history, same-sex intercourse and same-sex attractions revolved around fertility cult. They revolved around rain dances in ancient people groups. They revolved around pagan occult worship, not Judeo-Christian worship, it was nature worship. During the high noon of pederastia, it was occurring everywhere. A couple of Greeks and a Roman said, "Hey, maybe there's a biologic connection." It didn't gain much weight throughout society. No one ever took it seriously. No one ever claimed to they themselves have been born gay. No one. Then you've got 1862. Carl Henrik Ulrichs comes up with this theory, which he took from Plato's Symposium, which was one of the three Greek and two Greeks and one Romans that I suggested earlier. He took that and he spun it into his own theory. He had been molested as a kid, which probably explains the same-sex attraction. Classical conditioning states that if you eat something that tastes good, you're going to want to do it again. And if the kid doesn't understand sexuality, engages in a behavior that feels good, he's going to be conditioned to associate, you know, a positive feeling with a certain member of a gender. And we talked about the beginning of the gay identity. We talked about how it migrated to America with Henry Gerber, when he served with the armed forces over there from 1920 to 1923. He formed an American pro-sodomy organization. He molested Champ Simmons. Champ Simmons molested Harry Hay. Harry Hay created the first national pro-sodomy organization. Harry Hay was a child molester. He advocated NAMBLA, North American Man Boy Love Association. He was the founder of the gay rights movement, modern movement. We talked about how they became fascist during the Stonewall riots, used their new extremism to pressure the APA. And we talked about the fact that that sodomy was criminal, and so they wanted to decriminalize it. And in order to do that, they had to achieve minority status as a suspect class. And they believed that that argument would lead to the overturning of anti-sodomy laws, so they adopted the born gay hoax. And then we went over some of the methods that they wanted to employ to convince people that they were born gay. In the book, I also debunk every single study ever conducted that purports to prove people are born gay. The hypothalamus study was a fraud. The gay gene study was a fraud. The twin study was a fraud. The finger length study was a fraud. The eye blinking study, those are fraudulent on face value. I mean, those studies are ridiculous. I go into several homosexuals who talked about how they feel they developed their same-sex attractions, so the causes. I've talked about, in the book, I also go into reparative therapy, why it works, and the propagandistic method by which they created pseudoscience to tell the APA that no, reparative therapy is not legitimate, when in fact it is. And then I kind of talk about the threat to religious liberty. And finally, at the end, I talk about the natural law and why the behavior is immoral, specifically because it detaches a person from the reality of who they are, of what human nature is. And anything that detaches a person from reality is intrinsically immoral and disordered and therefore an evil. And so that concludes everything I think I have to say today. Thank you for your time.
We're gonna keep where we are. Anyone who needs to use the restroom, just on your own, quietly get up. We'll keep it together as a meeting.